Amen. Awesome. Thank you. Okay. No, we've already talked about all that. All right. We last class talked about the arrow connecting our identity with our works. And today I want us to dive into our works. And there's different ways in which we can engage this. I'm going to engage it with another question. It is, what is biblical justice about? I mean, we're still laying down the foundation, theological foundation of biblical justice. I mean, I think it also can be appropriately applied to Christianity as a whole. But this class is emphasizing the justice aspect, and we will eventually get to justice works, eventually. But right now, I want to answer the question, what is biblical justice about? Or what is it that drives biblical justice? In some sense, I'm asking us to define biblical justice again. If you guys remember in the first couple of lectures when we were defining biblical justice, yes, I defined it with some pictures on the screen, but one of the other things I said was biblical justice is setting the wrongs right. That was one of my several definitions. Setting the wrongs right. Biblical justice is acting, functioning, imitating Christ, absolutely. But whenever we looked at the works of Jesus, his words and his deeds, when we saw his identity and the way that it played out, when we looked at his accomplishments, one of the things that we could say about each of the categories is what Jesus was focused on was setting the wrongs right. Whatever the wrongs that had been incurred in Genesis 3, Jesus was now restoring, redeeming, returning us back to, or setting them right. So what I want us to do is I want to ask the question, what was wrong and what is being set right? So turn to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. We've alluded to this passage multiple times when we're asking the question of... When we're mining the depths of what it means to be created in the image of God, which comes from Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. In Genesis chapter 3, though, the image of God becomes the key point through which Satan gets humanity to rebel against God. So Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? No, that's not true. The woman said to the serpent, we may eat from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, which isn't true, or you will die. Oh, you will certainly not die, the serpent said to the woman. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God. Whose idea was it for humanity to be like God? God's idea. He created them in his image. And Satan just twists it just a touch. Just a touch. Which is the very definition of deception. I mean, it's kind of funny to me whenever I talk to people about different ways I see Satan is deceiving the nation or the church or whatever. Very subtle ways. And sometimes the reaction is, man, it's just so hard to see. Yeah. Like, it would be a terrible attempt at deception if it was obvious. And I don't mean that sarcastically or even pejoratively. I just mean it in the sense of that's what deception does. It takes something that's beautiful, wonderful, and just slants it a bit, just a touch, just enough to actually pervert all that is beautiful and set before you. He just twists it. Actually, God doesn't want you to eat from it because he knows you'll actually be like him, knowing good and evil. He knows that. Yeah, he knows that you will be like him because it was his idea to be like him to begin with. Now, one of the things I find very interesting is that the text never says that they must never, ever, throughout all of eternity, eat from this tree. The command is not now. That's the command. You can't eat from this tree right now. That's what we know. It doesn't mean God would never have eventually got to a point where he looked at Adam and Eve and he says, now you're ready to actually eat from this tree. Never do we see God precluding that as being a possibility. It is a possibility. But what we know God is saying is, not now. You can't handle it now. It'd be like giving a steak to a baby that's only still, you know, on breast milk. It's just not a good idea. It would choke. It's food, sure, but it's not food the baby can digest. Is this making sense? So he twists it just enough. Just enough. As you whistle at me. Just enough. In order to get them off kilter. In order to get them, longing, lusting, maybe is the right word. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. I've made a pitch for this book before, and I'll make another one. Paradise Lost, John Milton. One of the most amazing books I've ever read. Phenomenal. Phenomenal book. From around, I believe, around the 1500s. Because I think, Dante was in around the 1200s. Which they are written in similar styles, but Paradise Lost, John Milton, whenever this moment happens, when she eats from it, there's this powerful moment where it says that all of creation let out a groan and a sigh because nothing would ever be the same again. It's this powerful moment. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her. Let's not forget that the dude was there the whole time. And he ate it too. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. And we've been doing the same thing with vulnerability ever since. I mean, that's ever since the Garden of Eden. Anytime we feel vulnerable or ashamed of a wound or of a past, what do? We try to figure out unique ways to cover it up. Maybe we just sew some fig leaves together. It's the MO. It's a natural defense mechanism in a fallen state. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" I love that. God of pursuit. First question after the fall is, "I'm looking for you. Where are you at?" Now, it's not like he didn't know where they were. But whenever man chooses to hide from God, he pursues, but he does not force. He woos, but he does not coerce. He says, "I'm looking for you. Where are you?" And man has the opportunity to no longer be hidden, or man has the opportunity to continue to hide. I was talking to my friend just about some of the stuff that I'm wrestling with God right now, and one of the things he used to compare to God, and I found this to be wonderful, is he said, "Yeah, I mean, God is like a cactus." He said, "In the middle of the desert, you know that it is the only thing that can keep you alive because of the water that's stored inside of it. And yet, when you draw close to it, you still know in order to get to that deep water, it's going to be prickly. It's going to hurt." And in a fallen state, that's always what happens whenever you come close to God, the God of love, the God that pierces all vulnerability. Drawing close to Him inevitably incurs some pain, even if the living water is just on the side of that pain. And so they hid from him because he drew near to them, and yet he still pursued, "Where are you?" He answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." Oh, who told you you were naked? Darn it. Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from? As a father, there's nothing that's more frustrating then when you watch the innocence of your children just peel away. And my wife always laughs at me whenever I say this, but it is true. I got teared up the first time we had to put lotion on my son, my oldest son. I mean, I caused me to get a little emotional. I was like, "Ah." And she was like, "What?" I was like, "When he came out of the womb, his skin was wonderfully smooth." I said, "But it's just a reminder to me that he's already decaying. Like he's already, I mean, he is. He's already being affected negatively by our world. And now we have to put lotion on him." Oh, the very first time that my son was sitting at the table and he was like, "Yeah, you know, I don't know." He's like, "This one kid at school got in trouble today because he said the word," and he drops the F-bomb. And I'm like, what? He was so, he had no idea what was going on. And I was kind of like, and inside of me, I was mad. I was like, "Who told you? Who told you you were naked?" You didn't even know this stuff. You're so innocent. What? Who told you this? For the very first time that my daughter was called fat, ooh, man, she didn't even know that was a thing. Didn't even have a clue that was a thing. And then some random punk kid decides they're going to say it to her. And she comes into me crying because she didn't know it was a thing, but whenever she realized what it was that they said and how it made her feel, all she knew how to do was cry and to fall into the arms of her dad. Moments of innocence when they're stolen is you almost have to read Genesis 3 through the eyes of the broken heart of a father more than a God that's ticked off and ready to punish people. That's not what's happening here. It's a dad whose children's innocence is being stripped away from them, ripped away from them because of the brokenness of others. And he said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I told you not to eat from? The man said, the woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. Ah, we do that too. Oh, always looking to pass the blame. Whenever you're trying to blame someone, it's because you're actually wrestling with your own shame. People that are shame resistant don't feel the need to pass blame onto other people, but they also don't feel the need to take more blame in a situation that actually belongs to them. They take exactly what is theirs. Instead, what does he lead with? Actually, he leads not just with an accusation of the woman, he leads with an accusation against God. I mean, if you notice, that's what Adam does. He says, the woman you put here with me. There's part of Adam, he's going like, hey, listen, man, I'm an innocent bystander. Yeah, it was her fault and your fault for even giving her to me. And God's like, I'll overlook that one. Adam's just not receiving any of his portion of the problem. Then the Lord said to the woman, what is this you've done? What does she do? She passes the blame. The serpent made me do it. Just break the chain of passing the blame in your own life. Just knock it off. Like, listen. The whole point of diving into your past and dealing with your wounds is not to figure out who to blame. It's to figure out who you are so you can actually, clearly, emphatically embrace what you are and what you are not. It's not to pass the blame. It's not to vilify anyone. It's to see everything clearly. That's the whole point. Because whenever you get into this blame game, what you're doing is running from your own wounds and your own shame because you know you are wrong. You see the issue? Adam's like, it was your fault and her fault. And she's like, it was the serpent's fault. And it's like, it's all y'all's fault. Everybody has a piece in this. It's like every time I've ever counseled a couple that is on the road to or has already gone to divorce. Every time, I always know both are wrong. Both are wrong. I mean, in every situation I've ever been involved in, even ones whenever there was a clear victim, usually whenever you're dealing with a covenantal relationship, somewhere along the train, both are wrong. Now, some may be more wrong than others, but everyone has blame. So take what is yours, but don't take too much. But definitely don't try to pass it all off. So the Lord God said to the serpent, well, because you have done this, and then he gives them the consequences. What I want to focus on, though, is verses 16 and following. To the woman, God said, I will make your pains in childbearing very severe. With painful labor, you will give birth to children. I know it says, I will make. And so it almost sounds like God is inflicting something here. But the more I've wrestled with this theologically, both in the light of God's character as revealed in Christ, and the way in which Christ also engages with consequences of actions throughout, not just throughout what happens on earth, but even after we die, I almost am tempted, I don't know if tempted is the right word, although it fits the genre of the text we're talking about, to really describe what God's doing here as more of a description of the natural consequences of their actions than it is something that he's now creating as a measurement of punitive judgment. You understand the difference? In other words, I almost think that God's going, the system I put into place that would actually allow you to transform into my image infinitely, Now you have significantly altered it to here is what is the natural consequences of what is to follow. He's like, I put a system in place so that you would naturally do this. But because of your obedience, or actually your submission to a new master known as death, there is still going to be a progression, but now it's moving downwards because that's where your master resides now. So in other words, I think what God's going is, he's describing the natural consequences to the actions that they've done. He's saying transformation or change was always a part of the narrative. But it was moving up because this is where I sit. That's me. He says, but now all you've done is you've taken this and you've pointed it to a new master, death. So the system is in place. You just have repositioned the trajectory. And as a consequence of your repositioning of this trajectory, well, one of those consequences is you will have pains in childbearing and they'll be very severe. Why? Because that's what death does. Death and pain go hand in hand. Suffering, even suffering between you and yourself, will be a part of this new existence. With painful labor, you will give birth to children. What God is describing in Genesis 3 throughout all of the quote-unquote curses, although again, I almost want to call them consequences as opposed to curses, because curses almost seems like God is creating them in the moment, and I don't think that's what's happening. Is God's describing the shattering of four relationships that he created in order to actually draw you closer to him. So these relationships were created so that in engaging each of those, it will result in transformation further into the likeness of God, to the image of God you were created in from the beginning. You follow me so far? I know we're taking a couple of steps down into the theological well, but we need to in order to understand what's happening. The first relationship I think he's describing here is the shattering of the relationship between humanity and self. Humanity and self. There's a brokenness inside of ourself because of the repositioning of this trajectory towards death. I mean, this is very easy to prove. And we're actually going to look at each of these in detail over the last, however many classes we have. 5 classes. Over the last 5 classes, we're going to look at each of these in detail. But humanity and self, I mean, that's easy to prove. I mean, many of us in here, I'm not going to ask for a testimony. Many of us in here don't even really know who we are. You've ever felt that, maybe? Like, man, I don't even know who I am anymore. Or you'll do an action, you're like, what was that? Why did I do that? Why did I say that? I didn't even mean that. That's not even who I am. Or my goodness, the distance between us and ourselves sometimes is the distance between us and a mirror. Where we look at ourselves in a mirror and all we see is brokenness and a mess. Man, sometimes the hardest thing to do, as we even prayed about this morning, the hardest thing to do is just to look into ourselves and actually wrestle with what it is that's there, from memories to wounds to preferences. One of the most difficult things you can do because of the fall is to be introspective, is to wrestle with who you are. And that's a result of this. That's whenever he's saying, listen, as a result of repositioning this trajectory towards death, you will be at war with yourself. For even in child labor, even when you are creating in the way in which I, the Creator, create, which I think is so fascinating. Whenever we talk about the value of women, I understand feminism doesn't allow me to emphasize this too much, but I'm sorry, but I think it's kind of cool that women can actually bear children. I mean, that's something that I think God intentionally gave to women because it draws them, it puts them in a category with God that man can't get there. Like, yeah, man can create, like, you know, I don't know, they can like build a table. Not that women can't do that, but that's way different than birthing a child. You know what I mean? I mean, oh, I loved it when my wife was pregnant. I mean, I loved it. She glowed, but there was always a part of it too that I was like excitement on the outside because she was, our children were moving inside of her. I was like, that's crazy. You know, of course, I would always have like my ear to her stomach, or I'd have my hand to the stomach, and every time they'd be kicking or playing soccer or whatever, like I always would want to be near. I would sing into her stomach. Because, I mean, I wanted to be close to that too, but there is something that God gave to women alone that puts them in the same category of him, as him, and that is creator of a living being. That is an unbelievable category, an unbelievable holy moment. And yet, in that unbelievable holy moment, the fall says you're now at war with yourself in that beautiful moment. For now, even in childbearing, you will experience great pain within your own body. There's a shattering of a relationship, you see in this? Something is breaking in the fall. Keep reading. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. The word desire there doesn't mean like, wow, he's hot. Like, that's not what it means. Your desire for your husband means you will long for the position of authority that your husband will have over you. Now what's interesting is that, let's think about this for a minute. That is a result of a fall. I always think that we kind of forget about this, you know, like some guys are always like, yeah, that's right, I'm the man of the house. And I'm like, that's a result of the fall. I'm just making sure we're all on the same page here. Even the very question of who is in charge is birthed out of a self-preservation that is only the language of death. Who is the biggest authority? That's a death question. That's not a God question. Just ask the Trinity. The Trinity is not in this question of, okay, now which one's more important? Is it the Son? Is it the Father? I mean, is it the Spirit? They're not asking these stupid questions. Why? Because authority is not something that they're grasping for. It's not something they're longing for. It's effectiveness, it's transformation, it's creation, it's way bigger than what authority could ever even reach towards. But it is the fall that creates this animosity between a husband and a wife, between male and female, between, and this is the way I'm going to describe it, between humanity and humanity. I'm intentionally using the word humanity as opposed to mankind because I don't even want the word to be gender specific. Because I want us to be able to see very clearly this is a problem between male and female, between male and male, between female and female. I mean, come on. If we went into the dorms and we walked through, let's just say alumni, I bet we could prove this relationship is suffering between female and female. Yeah? I mean, the women, you're the only ones that can give a testimony on this, so if this is an unfair caricature, I apologize, and you can correct me. But do females get at war with each other at times inside the dorms? Are they territorial at all? I'm just asking. It's a question. It's not a... Okay. Your response will be what is teaching in the class. And all of you have this, oh my gosh, it's like you're envisioning something that happened before you came here. That's what I see on your faces. Yeah, you can prove this very quickly. I mean, my goodness, whenever it comes to female and female animosity, it can get vicious. But males don't act like that you aren't just as bad. See, when females get upset with each other, they throw verbal bombs at each other. When males get upset, they just bomb other countries. It's the history of warfare, is males getting upset at males, and then everyone suffers for it. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not just females that are territorial, right? It's males. And they actually wear it as a badge of honor whenever they can punch someone hard enough where they don't get up. I mean, you flip on CNN and you can see this relationship is shattered. Humanity and humanity is just persistently at odds with each other. Persistently. Male and male, female and female, male and female. It's not hard. Turn on CNN for 20 minutes and it'll prove my point. This relationship is shattered. And it is a part of changing transformation from towards God to now towards a new master known as death. Keep reading. To Adam he said, because you listened to your wife and ate the fruit from the tree about which I commanded, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. And it will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. This is one of the relationships we commonly overlook. But what also is shattered in the fall is the relationship between humanity and creation. Now notice, the reason why I'm even describing each of these relationships is because these categories of four relationships, if they are engaged in a way that was before the trajectory was changed, each of these four relationships would contribute towards a transformation into the likeness of God. That's, in other words, whenever you engage creation in Eden, and even now, it's supposed to be something that draws you closer to the Creator. That's the whole point of it. To draw you closer to the Creator. To give you an opportunity to become more like God as God reveals Himself in creation itself. But a part of repositioning this trajectory is the relationship between humanity and creation is now so significantly altered, so drastically shifted, the relationship is so profoundly shattered that creation actually works against the revelation of God's identity as opposed to for it. And we experience this. I mean, if you know anyone that's a farmer, they know very clearly what this consequence feels like. I mean, my first full-time ministry was in a rural community. And our prayer requests, don't get me wrong, it had the typical health and wealth stuff that you find in any church. You know, this person's sick, this person's dying, this person got laid off, this person. But one of the prominent things all the time was praying for the right amount of rain. Right amount of rain. Why? Oof. If you didn't get the right amount of rain, then the thorns and the thistles would actually fight against the crops being able to be produced, and people's livelihood was on the line. Yeah, they had insurance that, you know, would back up if the entire crop was devastated, and that happened multiple times when I was there. But the insurance money was nothing compared to what they could have made if the fruit actually had just been birthed from the earth. And so, we were in constant prayer. I almost felt like, in a sense, like a rain doctor, you know what I mean? Like one of those witch doctor rain people that had to constantly, like, I gotta make it rain, gotta make it rain, gotta figure out a way to do it. But it's this. It's the shattering of the relationship between us and the earth, which is one of the things I always, and I'll point this out again later, and I will unabashedly repeat it, and I will act like I only said it once. The creation was never meant to just get you from one meal to the next. That's not what it was ever meant to do. It was meant to minister to all of your being. I mean, it was meant to heal you in ways. And I'm not even just talking about through medicines. I'm talking about even emotions. I mean, how did they gain knowledge in Genesis 3? By eating something from creation. Not by reading a book. Not by talking to another person. By actually eating a piece of fruit, it ministered to their mind, not just their growling stomach. That's what creation was supposed to be and do. And that's what it will be and do once again whenever all this is restored. But we're not there yet. Right now, we're experiencing the brokenness of relationships. And this climaxes, the narrative builds, and it climaxes, moving from one shattered relationship to another until it finally climaxes at the fourth one. Genesis chapter 3, verse 23. So the Lord God, banished Adam and Eve from the garden to work the ground from which he had been taken. And after he drove the man out, he placed on the east side of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a flaming sword flashing back and forth to guard the way to the tree of life. The broken heart of a father ends the narrative by describing the shattered relationship between humanity and God. The only pathway to unity between humanity and God is through separation now. That he's protecting them. It's actually a movement of grace. He's like, if you ate of the tree of life now, which I wanted to be able to give you. Notice, the tree of life was never something that he prohibits them from eating. Tree of knowledge of good and evil was. Ah, but now in this current state of fallenness, if they would eat of the tree of life, they would be in a perpetual state of fallenness. He's like, I don't want that to happen. I want to protect you by kicking you out, by separating you. This is the natural consequence whenever you change the trajectory of transformation and you gear it towards death. Death, which by definition is separation. Now, in order for God to restore these, he will have to pass through death and then bring us, reposition the trajectory back towards him. And that goes back to Jesus' accomplishments. What is he doing? He's descending into the very belly of the master, imploding it, and then repositioning the trajectory of Garden of Eden back towards God. Separation now leads to intimacy. You see what it's doing? Humanity's relation with God, though, is deeply affected, if not completely shattered. So, whenever I'm talking about biblical justice as setting the wrongs right, these are the wrongs I'm talking about. Setting what wrongs right? All of the broken relationships from Genesis 3. That's the wrongs that need to be set right. That's the wrongs that Satan accomplished that God refuses to let stay the same. These are the wrongs that God is moving towards and one day will make right. Turn to Revelation chapter 21. Revelation chapter 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. One of my favorite verses in the entire Bible. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. We've talked about it in here. That word for new is kainos, which means a newly restored 57 Chevy. Something that had been dilapidated, but now had been restored or redeemed and made new. That's the word there. A new heaven and new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. Oh, I love that imagery for two reasons. Number one, the imagery of sea throughout Jewish literature, especially in the book of Revelation, is always in association with evil. Evil and chaos. The beast of Daniel chapter 7, all four of them come out of the sea. The first beast in Revelation 13 comes out of the sea. As a matter of fact, even the Sea of Galilee, whenever the disciples are in their most intense moments of fear, it's whenever the sea is raging and Jesus at times calms it or walks on it. Sea was constantly associated with evil and chaos. And it says, yeah, that's not there anymore. That's reason one, number one, why I like that phrase. Number two, I like that phrase, is because John, the apostle, is separated from the seven churches of Asia Minor, those he loves, by a sea. Where he's on the island of Patmos, separate from them, but separation will no longer be the MO of this new creation. It'll be union, intimacy, restoration. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. You see this in there? A restoration of this. A restoration of humanity and its warring against itself now is beautifully dressed itself for it to be received by her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them, and he will be their God. Did you catch that? Did you catch that relationship that's being restored, humanity and God? I mean, he emphasizes it over and over and over. They will be with him, and he will be with them, and they will be his people, and he will be his God, their God, and he will be with them. I mean, relationships being restored that at one point were shattered. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There is no more intimate picture than a husband wiping away the tears in the eyes of his bride. There's nothing more intimate. There will be no more pain or no more death. There'll be no more death or mourning or pain or crying. Notice there's four things that it lists there. Why? Four is a number of completion, usually attached to the earth. For the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I'm making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. That's interesting. Sounds like this, yeah? Humanity and creation coming together. He'll emphasize that again in chapter 22. But then he goes on and he says, those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. Number four. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars. There's eight things listed there, the majority of which describe shattering of this relationship. Liars, murderers, adulterers. You see what he's emphasizing? This relationship's going to be restored, the broken relationship between humanity and humanity. They will not be there. Why? Because that's not what it is to set the wrongs right. They will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death. Turn to Revelation chapter 2. It's not an accident that the Bible ends where it begins. It's not an accident. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life. We're back in the Garden of Eden. Did you catch that? Stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. Listen to this next phrase. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Creation no longer gets you from one meal to another when all the wrongs have been set right. The leaves of the trees actually heal the brokenness of the nations. Whether we're talking emotional, spiritual, physical, the leaves of the tree of life heal all that is broken. A restoration of all of the relationships that has been shattered. And verse 3 summarizes it wonderfully for me. No longer will there be any curse. Satan will not have a single victory. That's God's ultimate goal when it comes to justice. Satan will not have a single victory from Genesis 3. He will undo everything Satan accomplished in Genesis 3. Not a single relationship will be left shattered. Not a single relationship that was broken will be left unmended. Satan will have not a single victory, not one. For the curse will be in reverse completely, so that the trajectory of transformation will be restored and the relationships will naturally follow. Whenever I'm talking about our works, what I'm talking about is restoring relationships. I mean, if I'm going to summarize our works, it's restoring relationships. What relationships? The four that were shattered in Genesis 3. This is what we do. This is what Christ did, was it not? Christ becomes flesh. Catch it? Christ becomes flesh. God becoming man in order to unify the relationship of humanity and God to its state of what it once actually was before the trajectory is moved. And while he is here, his teaching is healing the brokenness inside of people whenever they look at themselves and don't even find themselves worthy to touch the hem of his robe. Daughter, your faith has healed you. And he's also restoring humanity and humanity. Let me tell you who your neighbor is, Jesus says. While his sacrifice, as Romans 8 even reminds us, is restoring all of the brokenness and bondage of decay that creation itself is suffering under, that itself did not even subject itself to. No, Jesus has come to restore relationships. And guess what? Guess what? Guess what? That's what we do. That's what we do. What do? We do what Jesus did. I mean, this is the 1 John 2:6. What do? We do what Jesus did. We walked how Jesus walked. And what did Jesus do? My goodness, when he came down here, he was restoring relationships. He was restoring everything that was broken. I mean, this is the reason why reconciliation is such a big deal for Jesus, why forgiveness is such a big deal for Jesus. Well, he'll say things like this: you'll be forgiven with the measure with which you forgive. Well, why in the world would he say something like that? Because at the very core of that is the restoration of broken relationships. You see, what Satan's entire job, or what his entire goal is, the methodology with which he will attain his highest goal, is through the breaking of that which God has created, specifically the relationships between, well, these four areas, these four components. This is what Satan does. So, whenever you're dealing with people that are struggling, one of the things they tend to do, as we prayed about, Jesse, is isolation. What's isolation? Nothing more than shattering relationships, severing themselves. It's why, where do you find the demoniac whenever Jesus lands on the shore of the Gerasene region? I mean, where do you find him? By himself, in a cemetery, death, cutting himself with potsherds, and then shrieking out against God himself. I mean, it's exactly what you would expect to find somebody aligned with Satan, perpetuating the brokenness of every relationship that was shattered in Genesis 3. And whenever Jesus exorcises him, all of a sudden now, not only is he physically restored out of a location that's been barren by all of creation, but he's restored back to humanity. Go back into the city. Can I go with you, Jesus? You are with me, but I want you to go back to the city, restoring relationships. You see this everywhere. Everywhere. I mean, how does Jesus interact with the sea? By restoring it to the proper relationship with humanity. I mean, how does Jesus interact with water? He turns it into wine so that creation can provide for humanity. Everywhere. You look at almost every miracle, every teaching, Jesus is interacting with restoring these four. That's what he does. And as a result, that's what we do. We restore relationships. This is what I'm describing here. What I'm describing here is your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. That's what I'm describing. The answer to the Lord's Prayer is us. We've talked about that. But that, this is what I'm talking about. What is the question or the prayer that God, that Jesus is asking God? It's for the kingdom to be restored, the kingdom of heaven to now be played out on earth. How? Through the restoration, through the bride. This is why it is very truly can be stated that the church should be a taste of heaven. This is why I get really upset whenever I hear of churches. Paul gets really upset whenever churches are disunifying. It's because the church is supposed to be a place that sets the wrongs right, that restores broken relationships, not ones that create more brokenness. This is why ministers committing adultery is a big deal. This is why materialism inside of our pews is a problem. This is why things like pollution is a church Christian issue and not a political Democrat Republican issue. This is why. It's because every relationship that is broken in any sphere of civilization is the church's target to restore. Every relationship. This is why in the church, racial reconciliation should be something we do the best. This is why political affiliation should never define who it is that we are in the church. This is why worship wars should end in celebration and not a new church plant. This is why that inside the church, divorce rates should be plummeting, that depression should be eliminating. This is why cutting should be a thing of the past. Shame and guilt should be weapons we no longer use. This is why recycling should be an issue in the church. Global warming should be something that we are engaged in. Spiritual disciplines are something that we teach. That ecological issues are things that we actually tithe to alongside of missionaries. Why? Every relationship that has ever been broken in Genesis 3, we target. Why? Because that's who we are, because that's who he was. Shane, why do you care about clean water? Because that's a Genesis 3 issue. That's why I care about it.
And if I can help water become clean, that it might repair some of this, which might then lead to some of this, because now they have dignity and worth, which ultimately will be targeting this. And then the trajectory of transformation and likeness of God is now possible again. Why? Because of freaking clean water. You see, I don't care about justice issues because they're justice issues. I care about them because it is a manifestation of broken relationships in Genesis 3. It's a manifestation of victories of Satan in Genesis 3. And I will be as zealous about those broken relationships and setting them right as Christ was. And he was so zealous for them, he died for them. Is this making sense? Biblical justice, its very foundation, is not doing good things to help poor people. At its very foundation, it's setting the wrongs right that Satan accomplished in Genesis 3. And that includes all of it and then some. This is why. Salvation is still an issue for me. Why? Because of this. Because this salvation is the restoration of the relationship that will affect every other relationship. It is an entry point to individual transformation, through communal transformation, and through ecological transformation. And without this repositioning of the trajectory, none of these are even possible. But we have found out that we can't make this move on our own. Man can't reposition the trajectory. That's not the way it works. Why? Because that's not the debt we incurred whenever death became our master. No. This is the reason why God needed to become man, descend into the pits of death, well, of hell, and then to implode it from the inside out, creating the trajectory movement back towards God that is manifested on earth in the church. The bride beautifully dressed for her husband. Why? Why won't we grab the most beautiful garments to put on for him? Why instead do we continue to purchase and put on the perilous and scandalous garments that look more like a prostitute than a glorious bride? It's because we don't even know what it is that we're supposed to be doing. We don't even have a clue. Most of the time, whenever it talks about works, all we do is talk about spiritual disciplines. I'm not saying that's not involved. It will be when we talk about humanity and God. But I'm saying to reduce down what it is that Christians do down to merely devotions is severely underestimating what it is that Satan has accomplished and limiting our view so much so that we actually do damage to every other area as we are exalting this one over and above all of them. This one's supposed to be the conduit through which we actually are healing every other broken piece, not the opposite. Is this making sense? Are you guys tracking with me? Okay. Your thoughts, your comments. I want you to process this. What are you thinking?
Well, I like it because it gives a lot of clarity on the whole works thing, which has been an interesting topic. I mean, just talking about it with people and things like that, and I think a lot about a conversation I had over the summer with someone about works and faith and things like that. And my friend was preparing a sermon, and me and him were talking, somebody else was like, I think there's thought that he was going too hard on like the fact that how you transform is a depiction of whether you even follow Christ, which is a serious thing to stand up and tell to like high school, which is why we end up talking. But I'm wrestling a lot with how to share this. Because I think that it's something that's obviously evident in Scripture. I think you put it in a rather clear way, but it also is something that it's going to like slap people in the face to the level. I mean, I don't know how I can. I'm trying to think of how I can say this to people so that they might. I don't know. maybe I should just give it up to the Holy Spirit and do it anyways and trust that God will like do what he will do with it. But I wish everyone would understand this. Mm-hmm. But I know everyone won't understand it, and that's incredibly frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why one of the fruit of the Spirit is patience. You know? I mean, there's all, and you're not saying this, but I mean, there's a temptation in all of us where it's just like, oh, if everybody would just see the world the way I see it, then everybody would be better off. It's like, maybe. I doubt it. But yeah, the worst thing you can do is to become frustrated and hasty. Haste, haste, haste. That's the sin that Irenaeus describes Genesis 3. He says it wasn't disobedience that was the problem. It was haste. It's haste. They ate too quickly from the tree. I think that's dead on. We're not patient enough. That's why, I mean, I know. I mean, like, every time I pray, I feel like people probably are like, oh, he's praying and thanking God for his patience again. I am. For a multitude of reasons. Number one, I know who I am and how patient he needs to be. Number two, it is one of the most startling expressions of love to sit and wait. To sit and wait for someone to move. That is an amazing expression of love. I mean, it's what Job's friends did for a part of the time. And it was amazing what they did. They sat for days just waiting for Job to move. The bummer was they opened their fat mouths and said stupid stuff. But there is an amazing gift of grace and of love whenever we just wait. When we don't get frustrated with where people are not, but we're thankful for where they are, even if it's seven steps away from where it is that we would long for them to be, knowing that their progress and process is more important than the actual end goal. I mean, I was talking last night in Boatman at a floor devo, and that was one of the things I was emphasizing. I was like, listen, don't wish away any step of the process. Don't. If you're 39 days away from getting married, don't wish away 38 days. If you are in the middle of writing a paper, don't loathe the writing and just long for the end. Because what you find is when you get to the end, the presence of God is not more thick there than what he was in the process. And you miss major portions of the presence of God whenever you're skipping steps in a process. It's like being pregnant and frustrated that you have to wait 9 months. It is a gift of God that you get to prepare emotionally, physically, and spiritually for a child to come over a period of 9 months. Because if it happened too quickly, it could hurt the child as well as the parents. Patience is embedded in the very fabric of creation. And we get impatient with anyone or anything, it will damage whatever it is that we're in pursuit of. No, patience is a fruit of the Spirit. It's one of the, honestly, and I'm not telling you to do this, I'm just saying, whenever people talk to me about the whole evolution creation debate, which bores me to no end, I'm like, I just don't care at all. Remotely, I don't care about this issue. But honestly, I was like, listen, atheists, like, you know, you showing me all these missing link type, you know, ithopicathus, whatever type of people, I mean, it just doesn't mean anything to me. Really, the best theological argument that anybody could ever give me, but no one ever has, that evolution or long, you know, old earth creation is real, is God's patience. It's like I have much easier time buying into an evolutionary theory if it's depicted of a God planting a seed in the ground of a tree and then sitting for 100 years waiting for it to grow. That seems to match more who my God is. Now, I'm not saying that evolution's true. I'm just saying they're not even arguing with me about it accurately. But patience is embedded in the very fabric of existence. You don't plant a seed in a garden and it grows the next day. Patience. And if we become impatient with our congregations, with the people we're investing in, with our neighbors, impatience will immediately kill whatever seed is growing. I promise. The process is just as much, if not more important, as the end.
love the process, fall in love with the process of all processes. Yes, I'm not who I want to be, but I'm not going to wish away the process of becoming who it is that God's making me, because He is ever present and even palpably present in moments like these when I am not what it is that I will be. It's the process. It's the process. It's why He didn't just come down here on earth in a man form, a grown man form, and say, salvation. No, he actually engaged in 30 years of living to patiently allow salvation to unfold after thousands of years of people pining for it before then. He's patient. And it's in His patience that's actually embedded His love and grace. Impatience, by definition, is violence against time. You're raging against time, fighting, violently slaying time in order to get what it is that you want. And that is not our God, remotely. Do I hear what you're saying? 100%. Matter of fact, and if anything, I'm preaching to myself here, saying, Shane, be patient. Be patient with a country that is so impatient, they're willing to elect someone through reasons of fear and anger. Patience. Patience. William Wilberforce was rewarded his patience of 70 years fighting against human trafficking, and he died before the major bill was passed outlawing it. Patience. Patience. It's okay that people aren't at where you're at or where you want to be even yourself. It's not only okay, celebrate it. It's a wonderful, beautiful, mosaic mess that God is patiently putting into place, this wonderful tapestry of restoration. Like, you hear my heart in it? No, I mean, in other words, I'm saying, I get it. I get frustrated too. But if I'm the Lord trying to speak a word of something to us on that issue, I would just say, love the longevity. Love it. Other thoughts, questions? That's good, though. Keep wrestling with that.
Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about this because I think it's so important. But I'm struggling because, like, I'm thinking of a lot of people who need to hear this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, like you just said about being patient and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, like, this is week 13, right?
Yeah. Week 12. But
week 12, okay.
Yeah.
So it's taken us 12 weeks to get to this point.
Uh-huh.
If we didn't hear everything before this, it totally wouldn't even make sense.
Absolutely.
So, like, obviously we can't just be like, you need to know everything you just said today. But how do we know that people aren't rejecting what God is doing in them?
Mm-hmm.
How do we know that somebody's not rejecting the transformation?
Mm-hmm. You don't. You don't. All you can do is offer them the tools, but you don't know if they're picking them up and using them. And this is the incredible vulnerability of ministry. I mean, this is the pain of mentoring and discipling. Oh. Every time, I was talking to somebody about this recently, every time you enter into a new relationship of mentoring and discipling, it is filled with vulnerability and fear, because it's a very real possibility that you will invest tons of time and they will totally waste it. And it's happened to me multiple times. And it is incredibly painful. Not because you're going like, I can't believe it, you just crushed my gift. It's like, no, it's because you're going, you're choosing a path that's going to hurt you, and I don't want you to hurt. And I was talking to this person, they were pouring their heart out about how just hard it is for them to want to be that exposed in a process. And I just was like, listen, I get it. And then I said, and think about, from God's perspective, what He deals with every day. Every day. Putting people in our places, purposely not letting plans happen so that it protects you. And yet you persistently push and push and push until finally He has to set you east of Eden. The broken heart of a father. It's incredibly frustrating. It's incredibly vulnerable. It's incredibly difficult, because you cannot force people to transform And most of the time, you can't even gauge if transformation is happening in a good way. This is called being a parent. It's incredibly, incredibly frightening. And there is nothing I can do except for give them the tools and then empower them to do to put them in the best position possible to actually be able to use the tools to success. So because of my story, you know, my story of, you know, being at the age of six and being molested, I'm very sensitive like that with stuff with my kids, like very sensitive. If even like I even hear a joke that starts to move in that direction, or if one of my kids walks in on another kid whenever they're getting dressed, I usually have to go to my wife and be like, you have to handle this because I'm kind of freaking out. I like don't know how to handle it. And so we all, you know, probably like a half dozen times at this point, with Zion in particular, he's 12, but I mean, we don't do it like every year, but every so often we sit him down and we talk to him like, hey, has anybody ever touched you guys inappropriately? Has, you know, or if any, you know, we just kind of talk through those things that parents should do to protect their kids. And one time, one of our kids, it wasn't really as intense as what I was feeling at the moment. One time, one of our kids was talking about one of his friends touched some, you know, just it was touching inappropriately, but it was more kind of in jest, but I don't think it's funny at all. And so my wife later talked to me. She said, I was surprised with how calm you were whenever he was describing what was happening. And I said, you know, I long for my kids to never experience the pain I went through. But the bottom line is, I can't control it. All I can do is give them the tools and the opportunities to not experience it. But sometimes I also have to realize they get to choose. There's nothing I can do except for be there. This is the prodigal son. That's what the whole story about. I mean, don't get me wrong. The prodigal son, that perspective is startling. The brother is a startling perspective. But it's the father that stays in the same location, knowing that his son is out there destroying his life. That is the perspective that, it, to me, is the most disturbing of the whole parable, is that the father never left, even though he longed to bring his child in and never let him go. Like, and this was what I was struggling with recently with my son being called a name at school. I wanted to homeschool him. Just protect him, pull him in. If I would do that to him at this point it's not bully abusive at this point. If I would do that, I'm not actually giving him tools. I'm actually sheltering him in a way that won't help him. When it comes to the transformation of other people, you do not know if they're transforming. You cannot force them to transform. All you can do is stay in the same location with all the wonderful tools, and if they walk into it, you can throw them a party. But you can't do it for them. And that's what makes discipleship so vulnerable, incredibly vulnerable. Which is why getting yourself where you can be vulnerable is so essential. Because if you can't be vulnerable, what you'll eventually do is just protect yourself to the point where you're not helping anyone. You're not restoring any relationship. You're just captivated by the first one. Does that make sense? Oh, it's hard. But it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding when that one prodigal comes home. And man, do I throw a party. I love a good party. They're fun. It's just not something that you can guarantee. That makes sense? All right. Love you guys. See you on Wednesday. I'll remember the memory work, I promise.
You don't have to.
Yeah.